Chapter 10. Casualties. There came a point, a few years into my career, when I knew I had seen enough. Since then I have seen a lot more, but I have blocked it out. The soul stands only so much. Surgeon Master Gorica, after the exsanguination of Augustus the Ninth. From the sound of it, there was a hell of a brawl going down at Vevere Gate. The sky under the shield blazed up at intervals with explosive light, and sound drummed across the hive. It had been going on since daybreak. The baby, Yonsi, was crying plaintively and making sobbing, sucking noises. It had been doing it all night. Tona wasn't sure what to do. Dalin was sullen and quiet, and he slept in the back of the trash cave most of the time. Tona crawled forward out of her dugout and looked across the shell-ruined slopes. Below, half a kilometre away, lay the fenced and razor-wired troop billet of Gavunda Chemplant Store Barns, southwest. That was where the off-world soldiers lived, the pale-skinned, dark-haired ones with their black costumes and blue tattoos. Tona wondered if they came from a hive world too, if the blue tats were gang badges or rank marks. She dreamed of their food. There was a banquet fit for the Emperor, secured down there in the back sheds. She'd sent Dalin in to scrounge and steal a few times, but it was getting dangerous. Tona knew it was up to her now. The baby was weak and crying. She needed milk powder and basic nutrient paste. There were over 1,000 other refugees hiding in the trash slopes and crater plains in the shell-flattened manufactories near to her, but she never thought to ask any for help. Everyone in Vervenhive was on their own now. A particularly fierce airburst cracked the sky above Vevere, and Tona turned to look. She'd been to Vevere railhead a few times and had stood in the glass hall of the main station, now long gone, watching the snooty up-spine travellers move to and fro from platforms. Her twice-uncle Riker had run a snack stall there, and she'd also been a part of a pocket prey team for a few months. The Grand Terminus had awed her, even as she worked it. It had seemed to her a doorway to anywhere. If she'd had the credit, she'd have jumped a train south to the tropical hives, to the archipelago, maybe even to Vergast Badport, where, so they said, it was possible to buy a route to anywhere, including off-world. Vevere Gate had always seemed to her a way off this rock, a possible future, a promise. Now it was dead and burnt out, and callous off-world soldiers dirted it with brutal war. The baby was squalling again. Tona edged out of her bunker and looked back at Dalin.
"Stay with him. I will be back soon with food."
Tona slid down the rubble stacks and moved towards the wire fence of the troop compound. Tona crossed the ruinscape of the manufactories, industrial areas that had been leveled on the first day before the shield lit up. Shattered rock-crete buildings flanked the lips of craters 20 meters across or more. Ruptured metal sheeting and snapped pipes poked from the brick dust. Unrecognizable pieces of burnt machinery scattered the ground. Bodies lay where they had fallen, and after a month these were nothing more than loose husks of shriveled bone and ragged clothing. The rescue teams had taken away most of the wounded in the initial recovery, and Habbers had carried their own dead out. But still, bodies remained, crumpled and half-buried in the wide ruin. Carrion dogs, lean, diseased and mangy, haunted the rubble, scavenging what they could. Like her, she supposed. Though, unlike the hounds, she drew the line at feeding off corpses. There was a stagnant, rotten smell to the place, and sickness lingered. Thousands like her, mostly low-caste or the dispossessed from the outer Habs, had made this place a temporary home when the main refuge camps had overspilled. Tona Creed, like many of Vervenhive's base-level citizens, avoided the refuges, for though they offered food and medical rations, they also represented authority and prejudice. The VPHC controlled most refuges brutally. She saw others prowling the ruins, adults mostly, a few children, all thin and dark with filth, their clothes wretched and ragged. Some stared at her as she passed. Some ignored her. None spoke. She passed a store block where parts of the side windows were intact, and she saw her own reflection. It shocked her. A straggly pale thing with dirty clothes and sunken eyes looked back at her. She had expected to see the bright-eyed, cocky Hab girl with the flashy piercings and snarling smile. Seeing the leanness of her own face, she realized how hungry she was. She'd been blocking the feeling. Her empty belly knotted and ached with such sudden fury that she dropped to the ground for a moment, sitting on a cinder block until the pain eased enough for her to stand without cramps or wooziness. She took the flask from her belt and sipped a few precious mouthfuls from the drink spout. Half full, it was the last of a box of electrolyte fluid bottles she'd recovered from a mining store near Vervin Smeltery 1. She was sure that the fluid packs were the main reason she'd kept herself and the children alive for the last month. She hooked the flask back onto her belt and then took out her blade. The back fence of the military compound was just a few meters away now. It seemed deserted. Maybe they were all fighting at the gate. It sounded like it. Her brother Nake had given her the blade on her 10th year day, just a few weeks before he was killed in a gang fight in Downreach under the main spine. Nake Creed had been a member of the Verves, one of the key undergangs, and the knife's handle was decorated with a carefully carved Verve crest, a laughing skull resting in the dip of a Gothic V. Tona sported a few gang badges herself, an ear stud, a buckle, a small snake tat on her shoulder, but she'd never been properly blooded into any gang to speak of. She had run with a few gang crowds and known a boy or two who'd been gang-blooded. While she was with them, they'd each tried to induct her, but she'd resisted. The one thing Tona Creed had always known, ever since Nake had died of stab wounds in an unlit, downreach sewer 7 years ago, was that ganger life was dumb and pointless and short. She'd make her own way in life, be her own master, or get nowhere at all. The blade was a compact chain form, a thick, decorated grip with an extending blade of steel 15 centimeters long. A flick of the rubberized stud on the index finger ridge activated an internal power cell that made the blade edge vibrate so fast it looked still. But gack, could it cut! She touched the stud, and the blade purred. She switched it off and crawled towards the flakboard fence. The supply barn was dark, and as stacked with supplies as she remembered it. She couldn't read many of the labels on the crate stacks, so it was a matter of cutting them open and sampling them. The first she tried was full of small flat boxes packed with bootlaces. The second had cartons of stoppered metal tubes. Hoping they might be food paste, she squeezed a coil of black matter onto her palm and licked it. She spat, retching. If this is what the off-world fighters ate, they were truly from another world. She moved on, leaving the half-squeezed tube of camo paint on the floor behind her. Earpieces with wires and plugs. Power cells, rolls of gauze in paper wraps that smelled of disinfectant. In the next crate stack, foil packs of freeze-dried buckwheat porridge. Better. She dropped half a dozen into her bag, then added a handful more. She'd eat them dry if she couldn't find water. Then she found chemical blocks for fire lighting, and a pile went into her bag. Next, metal beakers. She prized one out of its packing, then another. Dallin would want his own. In the next row, pay dirt. Corn crackers in long plastic tubes, soya bars in vacuum packets. She pushed a dozen or more into her bag and bladed one open, cramming the soft, wet food into her mouth and gulping it down, brine dribbling down her chin and pattering on the floor. Tona froze, mid-swallow, her cheeks bulging, her stomach gnawing at her with a sudden input of food. A noise. Behind her, to the right, a noise her wolfish chewing had half hidden. She ducked into cover. A flashlight flickered between supply stacks, 3 rows away. She willed herself invisible and huddled behind a tower of mess tin crates, the blade in her hand. The beam of light jiggled around and she heard a voice uttering a snarl. The sudden crack and flash of a las weapon made her jump out of her boots. A carrion dog went racing past her, yelping and trailing a burned hind leg. She relaxed a little. The voice said something in an accent she couldn't work out. The flashlight wavered, then moved off and away. She darted across the aisle into the next bank of crates, a few slices of her knife, all the while listening to the darkness around her. Nutrient packs for first aid. Tins of soup that heated themselves when the foil strip was pulled out. Jars of air-dried vegetables in oil. Small, flat cans of preserved fish. Cartons of heat-treated milk. She took a handful of them all. Her pack was heavy now, and she was pushing her luck. Time to go. Light jabbed down into her face, making her cry out, and a hand grabbed her shoulder. Tona Creed had been taught to fight by her brothers, all of them gangers. Instinctively, she pivoted back into the grip and shoulder through the owner of the hand. The flashlight bounced away across the rockcrete barn floor, and the heavy male form bounced after it, barking out an oath and most of its breath. But it had her still, and even as it went over her, it twisted her round in combat-trained hands and threw her sideways into the crate stack. The impact stunned her. She tried to rise, hearing the other moving too. A few more oaths, a harsh question she didn't understand. She rose and delivered a spin kick into the darkness. It would be the VPHC, she was sure. She braced for the las shot, the bolt round, the mindset that would treat her no better than a carrion dog. Her spinning foot connected, and the figure went down with a bone crack, more rampant cursing. Tona ran for the crack in the barn wall. A much larger form tackled her from behind in the dark and brought her down on her belly on the rockcrete floor. She was frantic now, kicking and thrashing. Her assailant had her pinned by way of superior strength and technique. His weight slumped on top of her, and the flashlight winked on again, probing down at her wincing eyes.
It's all right," said a hoarse voice in tunefully accented low Gothic. "Don't fight me."
She looked up, fighting still. She saw the face of the off-world soldier, the young one, the man who had chased Dallin out of the barn weeks before. The blade purred in her hand, and she sliced it upwards. Cafran saw the vibroblade coming and threw himself aside, releasing his captive. It was the gang girl, the beautiful one he had glimpsed across the rubble when he had gone chasing the boy. She was on her feet now, menacing with the buzzing blade, head down. Knife combat stance, thought Cafran. Good enough to be a ghost.
Put it down, he said carefully. I can help you.
She turned and ran, heading for the slit in the fiberboard back wall of the barn. Cafran pulled out his las pistol, braced his aiming hand, and fired three times, blowing a ring of holes in the back wall of the shed around her. Daylight streamed in through the punctures. She skidded to a halt, frozen, as if expecting the next one to let the light shine through her, too. Cafran got to his feet, gun raised.
I can help you, he repeated. I don't want to see you live like that. You've got children, right? A boy, at least. What do you need?
She turned slowly to face him and his light, blade in one hand, the other raised against the stabbing beam. Cafran lowered it so it wouldn't blind her.
Trick, she said. What? This is a trick. Just shoot me, you geck. No trick.
He stepped forward and holstered his pistol.
No trick.
She flew at him, blade slicing the air. He flinched and grabbed her arms, rolling backwards to deposit her flat on her own back. The impact knocked her out for a moment. Cafran kicked the purring blade away. He pulled her up. She was coughing and gasping. She felt so thin and fragile in his hands, though he knew she was mean and tough enough to hurt him.
"What's your name?"
he asked. Her jabbing fingers punched into his eyes, and he bellowed, rolling back and clutching his face. By the time he struggled up again, she was pushing through the back wall to freedom. Cafran noticed she had been mindful enough to recover her blade. He ran after her.
Fairthew, stop! I want to help! Stop!
She looked back at him, her eyes as wild and mad as an animal. Her bulging pack was caught on a fork of fiberboards, preventing her from squeezing through the hole.
Get away! Get away! She shrilled.
He approached her, hands held wide and empty, trying to look unthreatening.
I won't hurt you. Please! My name is Cafran. My friends call me Caf. I'm a lost soul like you. Just a ghost without a home. I didn't ask for this, and I know you, Fething, didn't. Please.
He was a hand's reach away from her now, hating the fear in her face. She spat and howled, then jabbed her blade round and cut the strap of her pack. It dropped to the ground, but she was free. Abandoning it, she flew out of the barn and sprinted away across the rubble. Cafran pushed out after her, straining to get his greater bulk through the slit. He got a glimpse of her, looking back and terrified, darting over the splintered mounds of wreckage before dropping out of sight. Tona lay in cover for a few minutes, buried in the soot of a crater, stinking corpses around her. When it seemed the soldier was not following, she crawled out and ran a few meters to a slumped wall and hid behind it. Then She heard a crunch of boots on rubble and froze. 20 meters away, looking in the wrong direction, the black uniformed soldier was walking up through the ruins, her pack dangling from his hand. "Hello," he was calling. "Hello. You need this. You really do. Hello." He stood for a long while, maybe 10 minutes, looking around. Tona remained in hiding. Finally, the soldier put the pack down. "It's here if you want it," he said. A long pause. Then he walked back down the ruin slope and clambered back into the barn. Tona waited a full 15 minutes more before she moved. She ran from cover, scooped up the pack, and leapt away into the confused maze of the ruins. The soldier didn't reappear or follow. In a foxhole, she hunched and opened the pack, studying the contents. Everything she had taken was there. Everything. As well as 3 flasks of sterilized water, a field dressing kit, a pack of one-shot antibiotic jabs, some net-wrapped dry sausage, and a las pistol. The very las pistol she was sure he had fired after her in the barn. The charge pack was almost full. She was dazed for a while. Then she laughed. Gleeful, she took up the sack of trophies and ran back to her shelter, taking a wide route so she wouldn't be followed. It was only later, after she and Dallin had eaten their first good meal in a month and Yonsi was sleeping and content on milk broth, that she found the cap pin at the bottom of the pack. Silver, clean, an imperial eagle with the double head and the inscription, "Tanith First, by the grace of the God Emperor of Terra," on the scroll held in the clawed feet. In the gloomy dugout, her belly full, her wards fed and content, Tona Creed sat back by the light of a fire kindled from guard-issue chemical blocks and wondered where she would pin the crest. As gang badges went, it was better than most. Behind Vevere Gate, the dead dominated the streets and squares. Teams of Vervan Primary, work militia and Munitorum laborers, their faces masked by breathers or strips of torn cloth, carried the dead from the battle away from the smouldering railhead and laid them out in the open places north of Vevere for identification and disposal. Organ Sorik had brought his workforce in from the Commercia refuge after the fighting had died down, and he had put them to work assisting the morbid but necessary duty. He wanted to fight. Gak, but that brave Vervan primary officer, what was his name? Racine, the one who'd given them the chance to pull their weight preparing the defense. He'd given Sorik the taste of it. But for want of proper weapons, Sorik and his people would have been at the front that morning. Let Ferrozoika tremble to face the wrath of smeltery workers from Vervan One with the blood up. From what he'd been able to learn from those milling about him, some off-world guard, some North Col, Sorik knew the ferocious battle had ended with Zoika pushed out against all odds. He hoped to see Racine soon and slap the man's back and hear how the pioneer efforts his workers had put in had helped to win the day by building defenses the enemy couldn't overrun. There was time enough. With smeltery workers Ganif, Fafenge, and Moj, Sorik began loading corpses onto a handcart. It was filthy, bestial work. They tried to wrap each body in a skein of linen, and they'd been told to take tags and mark the identity of each on a data slate. But some bodies didn't come up in one piece. Some were only parts. Some parts didn't match up, obviously, with others. Some were still alive. The place was a charnel house. Body carts moved all around them. Medical and clearance personnel milled around, and the wounded shuffled in slow, weary lines away from the gate railhead, many exhibiting awful injuries. Every now and then, they made way for a truck or a trundling medical chimera speeding away to the medical halls. Sorik, his hip braced on his axe-rake crutch, leaned down and slid his paper-gloved hands under the armpits of a blackened, legless corpse. As he raised the cadaver, it groaned. "Medic! Medic!" he cried out, pulling back from the ruined thing he had been touching. A thick-set medical officer pushed through the milling crowd, a man in his 50s with a silver beard and the look of an off-worlder about him. Under his hall-issue crimson apron, he wore black fatigues and guard-issue boots.
"Alive?"
the medic asked Sorik.
"Gek me, I suppose so. Tried to move him."
The medic took out a flexible tube, put one end to his ear and the other to the blackened torso.
"Dead. You must have squeezed air out of the lungs when you lifted him."
Sorek nodded as the medic stood up, folding his scope tube away into his shoulder-slung pack.
"You're off-world, right?"
asked Sorek.
"What?"
asked the medic, distracted.
"Off-worlder?"
The medic nodded curtly.
"Tanith first. Chief medic."
Sorek stuck out a hand, then pulled the paper glove off it.
"Thank you," he said.
The medic paused, surprised, then took the hand and shook it.
"Dordan. Gaunt's first and only."
"Sorek, I used to run that place."
Sorek gestured over his shoulder at the ruin of Vervin Smeltery 1, east of the railhead.
"This is a bad time for all of us,"
Dordan said, studying the bullish, noble man who leaned on his crutch, black with ash. Sorek nodded.
"That eye wound, has it been treated?"
asked Dordan, stepping forward. Sorek held up his hand.
"Old news, friend. Weeks old. There are others more needy of your skills."
As if on cue, VPHC troops wheeled past a cart carrying a screaming, blood-soaked North Col soldier. Matane and one of Kurth's people hurried to it. Dordan looked round at Sorek.
"You thanked me. Why?"
Sorek shrugged.
"I've been through this from the start. We were left to die. You didn't have to come here, but you did, and I thank you for it."
Dordan shook his head.
"Poor Master Makaroth sends us where he wills. I'm glad to be able to help, however."
"Without you off-worlders, Vervenhive would be dead. That's why I thank you."
"I appreciate it. Mine is often a thankless task."
"Have you seen Major Racine? Vervin Primary, he's a good man."
Dordan shook his head and turned to where stretcher-bearers were beginning to bring the Tanith wounded out of the war zone. Troopers Milo and Baffles were carrying Manic, howling from the wound to his groin, blood dribbling over the edges of the stretcher. Dordan moved in to deal with Manic. He was sure the young trooper was going to bleed out any moment. He looked around at Baffles and Milo as he worked.
"Racine, you know what happened to him?"
Dordan's hands were already slippery with Manic's blood. The groin artery had burst, and he couldn't tie it. It was pulling back into the body cavity, and Dordan bellowed for Lesp to bring clean blades.
"Major Racine,"
Milo said, standing back from Manic's stretcher, adjusting the dressing on his shoulder wound.
"He died under a flat crab.
He killed it, but he died." Sorek listened to the off-world boy and shook his head sadly. Lesp stumbled over the rubble and brought Dordan a scalpel. Dordan used it to try and open the screaming Manic's groin wide enough so he could push his fingers in and pulled the severed artery down to clamp it. It was too late. Manic bled out through his body cavity and died with Dordan's hand still inside him.
"Let me take him,"
Sorek said, and, with his men, he gently lifted Manic's body onto his wheel cart. Dordan was almost shocked by the reverence.
"Every soul for the hive, and the hive for every soul,"
Sorek said over his shoulder to the blood-soaked Dordan as he wheeled the dead ghost away. Anna Kurth moved her orderlies through the confusion of Ververe Gate. There were more dead to recover than living. She checked each corpse in turn, pulled off the tags, and then left them for the recovery units. She hesitated slightly when she found the corpses of Tanith. These were all Dordan's friends. She took off their tags carefully and entered all the names in her data slate. In the gateway of Ververe, she paused. She checked the latest set of tags three times to be sure. Tears welled in her eyes, and she pushed the bloody tags into her apron front. The 32nd day drew to a close. It was a day the citizens of Vervenhive would remember perhaps more keenly than anything that had taken place so far. Despite the success of driving back the first storm 3 days before, this seemed much more of a victory. Scant hours after the battle, the defense of Ververe began to take on a mythical flavor. In the Spine, the Habs, and the refugees alike, Vervenhivers spoke of it as a turning point, as the start of deliverance. Public address plates across the hive broadcast triumphant slogans, sanitized accounts of the battle, and pictures from the glorious front, mainly those showing the people's hero raising the flag in the shattered gate mouth, surrounded by jubilant Vervin primary troopers. In the Basilica of the Ecclesiarchy, a victory mass was organized, featuring a choir of over 10,000 and long liturgical readings from the Codex Imperialis. Loudspeakers broadcast the worship across all the hive levels. Spontaneous celebrations began in different areas, and some revels, amongst Vervan primary troops heady with relief, were broken up by the VPHC. But the mood was impossible to suppress in the highest and lowest quarters of the hive. Oil can fires were lit along the wharves and in the refuges, and drums, many homemade or improvised, thundered into the night. There were many reports of decadent banqueting in the high spine, as merchants and house ordinary families abandoned the rationing restrictions and indulged in sumptuous private dinners of unstinting debauchery. When Gaunt heard about them, he sighed. These were either gestures of ignorance or acts of denial against what must surely still await. But let them have their delights, he decided. They may be their last. In a grim mood, he'd stayed on at Vervaire as the light failed, touring his men, noting those lost, restructuring squads around those losses. He gave Trooper Baffles a field promotion to sergeant and placed him in charge of Fall's unit. The stocky, bearded trooper was almost overcome with emotion as Nescon, Domor, Milo, and the others cheered him. He shook Gaunt's hand and wiped away a tear that trickled down over his blue claw tattoo. There had been a brief rumor that Gaunt would award the sergeant pin to Milo, but that was absurd. He was barely a trooper, and it wouldn't look right, though Milo's actions and improvised leadership at Vervaire had won him a considerable respect that sat well with his reputation as the avatar of Gaunt. Under Corbeck's command, the Tanith units who had seen action at Vervaire pulled out to a mustering yard north of the spoil, and fresh units under Rawn, partnered with Volpone forces commanded by Colonel Corday, moved in to hold the gate position. Stonemasons, metalworkers, and engineers from the HAB workforce were called up to assist the sapper units in defending the gate. Using fallen stone from the gate top, the masons erected two well-finished dike walls just outside the gate, and the incandescent glare of oxylene torches fizzled in the night rain as the metalwrights crafted pavises and hoardings from broken tank plates. Sections of rail, and there were kilometers of it scattered throughout the railhead, were broken up and welded into crossframes to carry barbed wire and razor wire strings. In an intensive 12-hour period, with work continuing throughout the night under lamp rigs, the workforce raised impressive concentric rings of well-built defenses both inside and outside the broken gate. There were ramps along the eastern edge to allow forward access for the North Col tank files marshalled behind the troop lines. A forest of howitzers, barrels raised almost upright, like slightly leaning trees, was established on the site of the main terminus, with a clear field of fire to bombard up and beyond the gate. In the mustering yard, weary Tanith and North Col units from the front sprawled on rolled-up jackets or on the hard pan itself, many falling asleep as soon as they got off their feet. Mess trucks with tureens of soup, baskets of bread, and crates of weak beer arrived to tend them. It was estimated that they would be there until dawn, when the arterial routes would be finally clear enough for transports to carry them back to their billets. In the gloomy rear section of a North Col chimera, Corbeck and Bulwer shared a bottle and dissected the day. The performance of the Vervan troops, and of Modile especially, was cursed frequently. The bottle was vintage Sacra from Corbeck's own stock, and he broke the wax foil stamp with relish. Bulwer had set his power claw on a metal rack, and, flexing fingers, stiff from the glove, produced two shot glasses from a leather box and a tin of fat smokes, the best brand the Northern Collective Hives produced. Bulwer had never tasted the Tanith liquor before, but he didn't flinch, and Corbeck wasn't surprised. Bulwer was as grizzled and hardened a soldier as any Corbeck had met in his career. They clinked glasses again. "Anvil," Corbeck toasted, letting blue smoke curl out of his mouth to wreathe his face. Bulwer nodded. "Let's hope we don't need it again. But I have an ache in my leg that says there's a measure left before us." "Your leg?" Bulwer tapped his right thigh. "Metal hip. A stab round during the Moon War. Hurts like buggery when it's damp, and worse when trouble's coming."
"Weather's changing. More rain on the way."
"That's not why it's aching."
Corbeck refilled their glasses.
"But for this Moon War, you've never been off this place?"
"No," replied Bulwer. "Wanted to muster for the guard at the last founding, but I was a major by then, and my path was set.
planetary defense like my father and his before him. That's a noble calling. I could have wished for it myself, commanding the garrison of a city back home.
Where is that again?
Tanith? Korbak toyed with the tiny glass in his paw. He pursed his lips. Darangan. We're the last of it.
How?
We were founding. The first founding Tanith had made. Three regiments assembled to join the War Master's crusade. This was just after Balhaut, you understand. Gaunt had been sent to knock us into shape. There was a miscalculation. A chaos fleet slipped through the interdiction set up by the advancing Segmentum Pacificus Navy and assaulted Tanith. Gaunt had a choice. Get out with those troop elements he could save, or stay and die with the planet.
And he chose the former,
like any good commander would. I like old Ibram Gaunt, but he's a commissar at heart. Hard line, worships the Emperor above his own life. Dedicated to discipline, he took us out, about 2,000 of us, and Tanith burned, as we left it behind. We've been paying back the enemy ever since.
Bulwa nodded. That's why you're called ghosts, I suppose.
Korbak chuckled and poured some more sakura for them both. Bulwa was silent for a while.
I can't imagine what it's like to lose your homeworld.
Korbak didn't make the reply that flashed into his mind, but Bulwa saw the logic of his own words and spoke the unspoken anyway.
I hope I don't find out.
Korbak raised his glass. By the spirit of my lost world, he said mischievously, glancing at the sakura, may we ghosts ensure that there are never any Vergast ghosts. They downed their drinks with heartfelt gulps. Bulwa got up and began to rummage in a footlocker bolted to the carrier's hull. He pulled out map cases, ammo cans, and a sheaf of signal flags before finding what he was looking for. A tall-shouldered bottle of brown glass.
We've toasted with your Tanith brew, which I commend for its fine qualities, but it's only fair we toast now with a Vergast vintage. Jolik, 10 years old. Cask fermented.
Korbak smiled. I'll try anything once. He knocked it back, savored it, smiled again.
Or twice,
he said, proffering his glass. By a roaring oil drum fire, Baffles sat with Milo, Venar, Philaine, and Domo. Philaine and Venar were snoring, propped up against each other. Domo was spooning soup into his mouth with weary, almost mechanical motions.
I want you with me,
Baffles said quietly to Milo.
Sergeant? Oh, stop it with that crap. These pins should have been yours.
Milo laughed, and Philaine looked up at the noise for a moment before slumping and snoring again.
I've been a trooper for all of 10 seconds, and I'm the youngest Tanith in the regiment. Gaunt would never have been crazy enough to make me sergeant. You deserve it, Baffles. No one denies it should be yours.
Baffles shrugged.
You led us today. No one denied that either. You are trusted. So are you. We worked as a team. If they followed me at all, it's only because you did. They may think of me as some lucky fething charm touched by the commissar himself, but it's you they respect.
We did okay, though, didn't we?
Milo nodded.
Whatever you say, I want you at point. Right up near me.
Okay.
You're the sergeant.
And I'm making a command decision.
The men respect you, so if you're near me and with me, they'll follow me, too.
Milo looked into the fire. He could sense Baffles was scared by his new responsibilities. The man was a great soldier, but he'd never expected unit command. He didn't want to fail, and Milo knew he wouldn't, just as Gaunt had known when he'd made the promotion. But if it helped Baffles' confidence, Milo would do as he was asked. Certainly, through the strange organic process Milo had observed in the firefight that morning, soldiers chose their own leaders in extremis, and Baffles and Milo had been chosen.
Where's Tanith, do you think?
Milo glanced round, initially assuming Baffles had asked a rhetorical question. But the older man was looking up at the sky.
Tanith? Which of those stars did we come from?
Milo gazed up. The shield was a glowing aura of green light, fizzing with rain that fell outside. But even so, they could just glimpse the star fields, pricking the blackness. Milo chose one at random.
That one, he said. You sure?
Absolutely. It seemed to please Baffles, and he stared at the winking light for a long time.
Do you still have your pipes?
Milo had been a musician back on Tanith,
and before he'd made trooper, he'd played the pipes into battle.
Yes, he said. Never go anywhere without them.
Play up, eh?
No. My first order as sergeant.
Milo pulled the tight roll of pipes and bellows from his knapsack. He cleared the mouth spot and then puffed the bag alive, making it whine and wail quietly. The hum of conversation died down at fires all around at the first sound. Pumping his arm, he got the bellows breathing, and the drone began, rising up in a clear, keening note.
"What shall I play?" he asked, his fingers ready on the chanter. "My love waits in the Nalwood's green,"
Domo said suddenly from beside him. Milo nodded. The tune was the unofficial anthem of Tanith, more sprightly than the actual planetary anthem, yet melancholy and almost painful for any man of Tanith to hear. He began to play. The tune rose above the yard, above the flurries of sparks rising from the oil drums. One by one, the men began to sing.
"What is that?"
asked Bulwer hoarsely, as Corbeck sang softly. Across the yard, the Northcole men were silent as the bitter, haunting melody filled the air.
"A song sung by ghosts,"
Corbeck said, as he reached for the sacra. The main spire rang with the sound of massed voices. In the halls of the legislature and the grand regimental chapel of House Command, victory choirs, thousands strong, sang victory masses and hymns of deliverance. Crossing a marble colonnade with Captain Dower and several officers on the approach to House Command, Gaunt paused on a balcony and looked down into the regimental chapel auditorium. He sent his contingent on ahead and stood watching the mass for a while. 1,200 singers in golden robes, red-bound hymnals raised to their chests, gave voice to the hymn, "Behold the Triumph of Terror," in perfect harmony, and the air vibrated. The auditorium's high-arched roof was adorned with company banners and house flags, and censer smoke billowed into the candlelit air. A procession of ministerium clerics carrying gilt standards and reliquary boxes, their long ceremonial trains supported by child servitors, shuffled down the main aisle towards the imperial shrine, where Intendant Bainfail and Master Legislator Anofi waited. There were hooded administratum officials in the procession, and three astropaths from the guild, their satin-wrapped bulks bulging with tubes and pipes and feedlinks. The astropaths were carried on litters by adult servitors, and many of the tubes and pipes issuing from the folds of their cloaks were plugged to cogitator systems built into the silver-plated litter pallets.
"It lifts the heart, does it not?"
a voice from behind Gaunt asked. Gaunt turned. It was Cowl.
"If it lifts the morale of Vervenhive, so be it. In truth, it is premature."
"Indeed?" Cowl frowned, as if not convinced.
"I'm going to House Command. Will you walk with me?"
Gaunt nodded, and the two grim black figures in peaked caps strode together down the marble colonnade under the flickering ball lamps strung along the walls.
"This day has seen victory, yet you seem low in spirit."
Gaunt grunted.
"We drove them off. Call it a victory. It was bought too costly, and the cost was unnecessary." "May I ask on what you base that assessment, Colonel Commissar?"
They strode under a high arch where banners flapped in the cool air. The choir echoed after them.
"Vervenhive's command and control systems are inadequate for a military endeavor of this magnitude. The system broke down. Deployment was crippled behind the front and devastated at the sharp end. There is much to be criticized in the command structure of the Vervan primary itself."
Cowl stopped short.
"I would take such criticisms personally. I am, after all, the chief disciplinary officer of this hive."
Gaunt stopped as well and turned back to face Cowl. There was an immoderate darkness in the man's face.
"You seem to excel in your duties, Commissar Cowl. You understand, better than any man I have ever met, the uses of propaganda and persuasion. But I wonder if you hold the officer ranks in place by force of will and fear, rather than sound tactical order. The commanders of Vervan Primary have no experience of war on this scale. They know what they know from texts and treatises. They must be made to acknowledge the experience of active field officers, such as yourself and the other guard commanders like General Grismond."
"Just so.
I trust I can count on your support in this when we meet with House Command. I want you with me, Cowl. We can't be pushing from different angles."
"Of course.
I am of one mind with you on this, Colonel Commissar.
They walked on. Gaunt could read Cal's soothing tone, and he despised it. He was well aware of the 24 requests for transfer back into the active guard which Cal had made in the past 3 years. A master politico, Cal was clearly courting Gaunt's favour, assuming Gaunt could make a good report and effect him that transfer.
"I understand you executed Modile," Cal said matter-of-factly. "A necessary measure. His negligence was criminal." "It was, as you described, his inexperience that let him down. Was summary execution too harsh for a man who might yet learn?"
"I hope you would have done the same, Cal. Modile caused many deaths by his inaction and fear. That cannot be conscienced. He ignored both pre-orders and direct commands from above." Cal nodded.
"Where a seasoned guard commander would have held fast to the chain of command."
"Indeed." Cal smiled. It was an alarming expression on such a cruel face.
"Actually, I applaud your action. Decisive, forceful, true to the spirit of the commissariat. Many have feared the great Gaunt has grown soft now he has a command of his own, that his commissarial instinct might have been diluted. But you disabused that notion today with Modile."
"I'm glad to hear it." They had arrived at a set of great doors, ornate with golden bas-relief. Vervan elite troops in dress uniforms, crusted with brocade, with plumes sprouting from their helmet spikes, opened the doors to admit them. Beyond the doors, the audience theatre of House Command was seething with voices and commotion. General Nash was at the lectern, trying to speak, but the noble houses were shouting him down. Junior Vervan primary officers were stamping in their tiered seats and jeering, and Rowan Deeper adjutants were yelling back at them, urged on by officers from North Col, the Narmenians, and the Volponi. Vice Marshal Anko rose to his feet, slamming his white-gloved hand into the bench head for silence.
"While I welcome the aid our off-world kin have rendered us, I find this an affront. General Nash condemns our military organizations and says we are all ill-equipped to deal with this fight. An insult, no less, no more. Does His Highness General Sturm share this view?"
Sturm rose. "War, honored gentlemen," he began in soothing, mellow tones,
"is a confusion. Emotions run high. It is hard to say if a system is right or wrong until it is found wanting in the fire of battle. The Vervan Primary are exemplary soldiers, well-drilled and highly motivated. Their bravery is beyond question. That our command channels clash during today's engagement is simply unfortunate. It is not the fault of Vervan officers. I have already issued standing orders to range the Vox channels so that there will be no further overlap. Any deaths that have resulted from this misfortune are greatly regretted. Such incidents will not recur."
"What about discipline?" Gaunt's voice cut across the great hall, and all the faces turned to look. Gaunt walked to the end of the chamber and stepped up to the lectern. Cal took his place on the front bench, next to Anko.
"Colonel Commissar?"
Marshal Crow rose and looked down the vast hall into Gaunt's eyes.
"Is there another matter? General Nash has already been unkind enough to reprimand Vervenhive for its weakness in command. Do you share that view?"
"In part, Marshal. The communication problems General Sturm has referred to were only a piece of the crisis we face today. We were lucky to survive the Vivere assault." Anko jumped to his feet.
"And have we not our own hero, Commissar Cowell, to thank for turning that crisis around?"
The hall broke out in ripples of applause and cheers, mainly from the Vervan majority. Cowell accepted the applause with a gracious, modest nod. Gaunt knew better than to point out the cosmetic nature of Cowell's involvement.
"Commissar Cowell's actions are a matter of record. History will record the nature of his contribution to the Vervenhive War."
Gaunt couched his response carefully.
"But the line of command failed severely during Ververe. Field commanders of the Vervan Primary, whose bravery is beyond question, failed to relay strategic orders, or were unable or unwilling to redirect their forces in the face of the assault." Jeers and boos thundered down at Gaunt.
"I understand you have already exacted discipline, Colonel Commissar.
Anko said stiffly. And I will do so again, Gaunt raised his voice above the background roar. But that simply punishes the symptoms of the problem. It does not address the heart of it. That problem being a failure to obey direct orders? Cowl asked, rising to his feet amid more cheers. Gaunt nodded. Chain of command must be observed at all times. Any who break it must do so knowing they risk the highest penalty. Without such order and control, this war will be lost. I trust Vervan Primary will respect this philosophy from now on.
So, all who transgress must be punished?
Cowl asked. He wants his transfer badly, Gaunt thought. He's supporting me every step of the way.
Of course. Without the threat of sanction, insubordination will continue.
Then you will support the punishment of General Grismond?
Asked Vice Marshal Anko. What?
General Grismond, who broke orders this day and began his own deployment of the Narmenian armor.
Now the Narmenian staff booed and heckled. Gaunt faltered.
I was not aware of this. It must have been a mistake. General Grismond has my complete confidence and—
So one rule for the locals, another for the guard, sneered Anko.
I didn't say that.
General Grismond defied direct orders from House Command and redeployed his tanks through Noble House territory. Forgetting the collateral damage he caused, is not his action worthy of the most severe censure?
Tarion of the VPHC looked across at Gaunt.
That was the philosophy you were advocating, wasn't it?
Gaunt looked away from the hooded eyes of the VPHC commandant and found Cowl's face in the throng. Cowl smiled back at him, unblinking, soulless. He knew. He had known about Grismond even before they had reached the chamber. He had maneuvered Gaunt right into this trap. Gaunt realized in an instant he had underestimated Cowl's ambition. The man was after more than a simple transfer off Vergast. He was after glory and command.
Well, Colonel Commissar, what do we do with Grismond?
Asked Anko. Gaunt stepped away from the lectern and strode down the hall to the exit, yells and catcalls showering over him. Outside, he grabbed one of the Vervan elite minding the door by the brocade and slammed him into the wall.
Grismond, where is he?
In the stockade, sir. Level sub 40.
Gaunt released him and strode away. The rousing hymns of the great choirs shivered the air around him. Their sentiments sounded all too hollow. The sunrise was an hour away. A file of ghosts moved up from trucks parked on the Eastern Hab Expressway and entered the manufacturing depots that backed onto the spoil. 30 men, the cream of the Tanith Scout Cadre, the Vervan troops occupying the location, soldiers of the so-called Spoilers Unit, greeted them in the undercroft of an ore barn. The air was thick with rock dust, and the light was poor, issuing from a few hooded lamps nailed to the wall. Gak Orman, the major in command of the spoilers, saluted as McColl led his men in. He was a big, bulky man with bloodshot eyes and a flame-a-burned throat.
"I understand you have good snipers and stealthers,"
Orman said to McColl as he walked over to a chart table with him. McColl nodded. He surveyed the chart. The spoil, a vast heap of slag, was a real vulnerability for Vervenhive. They knew as much, otherwise they wouldn't have formed a dedicated defense force, but the battle of the day before had decimated the spoiler unit.
General Sturm has acknowledged the Tanith ability in such endeavors. We're here to support you.
Gak Orman's great bulk was clad in the blue greatcoat and spiked helmet of the Vervan Primary. He looked down at the wiry off-worlder with his faded black fatigues and curious piebald cape. He was not impressed. All of the spoilers present, including Orman, carried long-barreled autoguns with scopes dedicated to sniping. Their faces were striped with bars of black camo paint. Several had fresh wounds bound tightly. Sergeant McColl called up his men so they could all study the chart. The ghosts grouped around the table, making comments, pointing.
Why don't you just give them orders?
Orman asked disdainfully.
Because I want them to know the situation and understand the terrain. How can they defend an area effectively otherwise?
Don't you do the same? Orman said nothing. McColl broke his men into work teams and sent them away in different directions,
though not before checking they had set their microbeads to the same channel. Orman joined McColl as the sergeant led his group of McVenner, Domor, Larkin, and Rilke up shattered internal stairways to the third story overlooking the slag heap. 9 spoilers were stationed at the shattered windows up there, using scopes to watch the sleek slopes of the spoil. The ghosts took position amongst them. Larkin and Rilke, both armed with sniper variant lasguns, set themselves up carefully. Rilke used a length of pipe to disguise the end of his gun as it protruded from the wall. Larkin covered his own gun down to the muzzle under loose sacks. Domor took McColl's scope, set it up on a tripod stand in the shadow of a window, and linked his mechanical eyes to the sight. He could now see further and clearer than anyone in the fortification. Orman was about to ask McColl a question when he realized he and the ghost called McVenner had vanished. McColl and McVenner moved invisibly down the spoil slope, their capes spread over them. The coal-like ore refuse was wet and slimy underfoot. They were outside the protection of the shield, and the night rain fell around them, making puddles amongst the rock waste. They raised their scopes. Beyond the spoil, 2 kilometers away, they saw the open, flat land and the blasted habs beyond. The heavy rain was creating standing water on the flat soil, and the water was rippling like dimpled tin with the rainfall. Visibility was down, and cloud cover was descending. There was a sound. McVenner armed his lasgun, and McColl crawled forward. It was singing, chanting. From out in the enemy positions, via loudhailers and speakers, a foul hymn of chaos was ringing out to answer the triumph hymns of the hive. It grew louder. McColl and McVenner shuddered. In the ore works behind them, Orman felt his bladder vice and hurried away. At his position, Larkin tensed. He was weary from the day's nerve-shredding battle and had only been sent in with McColl's men because of his skills as a sniper. Every time he closed his eyes, he saw the face of the Zeuken. Now, from below, down the length of the spoil, he could hear them. The Zeuken filth were singing a name over and over, in a canon repeat. Heritor Asphodel, Heritor Asphodel.